May it please the court, my name is Daniel West. My bar number is 27573. And along with my law firm, Belton West PC, I have the pleasure of representing the plaintiffs' appellants in this matter, Alan and Cheryl Sidman. As both parties have done in their briefs, I'll refer to my clients as the parents and the defendant appellees as the guardians. It would be an understatement to say that this case has a long and complicated procedural history. However, the issues before this court are fairly straightforward. The main issue in my mind is this issue of whether or not, under the circumstances of this case, we treat the parents' income or the parents' support obligation either collectively or separately when the parents are an intact marital unit. Based on my research and my arguments before this court, and as I argued before the trial court, I believe that you have to, in fairness, deal with parents' income collectively in this type of situation. A brief note, in that I at least posited the question of whether 1410.115 even applies to this case. I don't think that that's really an issue. I think it obviously does apply, and I think that's for two reasons. One, I think it's the law of the case. Two, I also think that 1410.115.1c says that it applies to all child support obligations, and I think you can interpret it to say that it applies to all child support obligations. So, there is a plethora of case law, and I think the parties agree that the main purpose of this court interpreting a statute is to look to the General Assembly's intent. And I start with 1410.115.11c, which is the provision that says that a non-custodial parent gets a credit on their child support obligation, such as the case in this case, where a custodian receives support but also receives disability payments, and they get a dollar-for-dollar credit. When I look at that language, it seems very clear. What was the General Assembly concerned about? They were concerned about the recipient of child support receiving a windfall. And that's precisely what happened in this case and what the legislature did not intend.
Well, the recipient is the child.
Excuse me?
The recipient is the child. They're concerned about the child getting a windfall?
No, the recipient. Why would the legislature pass a statute that says the recipient is the child as a technical matter, but the recipient is the child, but why does the legislature give a dollar-for-dollar credit to the non-custodial parent's child support obligation if they weren't concerned about the child receiving not only the recipient of child support as well? And so what my question is, why was the legislature concerned about that? They wanted the basic support obligation to be enforced and that the non-custodial parent pay that amount and nothing more. And so that's why, otherwise, why have that provision in there?
So your windfall argument, frankly, is, I don't find that persuasive, because the money is the child's money, and we have case law that says that really consistently, that such payments like this belong to the child. That's the child's resource.
And I agree with that, and I absolutely agree with that, as is the child support is the child, so is the disability payments that they receive on behalf of the non-custodial parent.
Okay.
It still goes back to the issue of why did the legislature put that in there? Because they didn't want to. The better way is not to say a windfall to the recipient, but as to not deal an unfairness to the person paying child support is the way I would look at it.
Well, counsel, getting back to the text of the statute, it doesn't talk in terms of a non-custodial parent generally. It talks about a non-custodial parent who has a disability, and as a result, disability payments are being made. So we can't read that term non-custodial parent in a vacuum, it seems to me, which is what you're asking us to do.
No, I certainly goes down to the guardian's argument, which is the child support statute deals in the singular in many respects with a parent, and likewise that statute 1410.115.11c deals with the parent receiving the disability payment. I don't think the legislature ever assumed that this would apply in a situation such as this. This is a unique factual circumstance where we have a married couple, married parents, that deal with their finances collectively. They pay their obligations collectively. And what the trial court did and what the guardians are asking to do is to forget all that. Forget the fact that they've made choices in their life. Forget the fact that one person has decided to stay home and they've decided to deal with their finances collectively. So I don't think the legislature intended that. And I cited People versus Terry,
which says, yes, you ordinarily give the plain and ordinary meaning to the legislature. However, if we look at that and it would result in an absurd determination, or if it would result in undermining what the intent of the General Assembly is, then we're going to use common sense. And that's what I think. Normally, you're going to use plain and ordinary meaning, but this was clearly not a situation. And if you look at, I think it's 14, 10, 115, 8, A, it talks about a parent paying another parent. So we know what the General Assembly was concerned about. They were talking about disputes between parents, not a dispute like this. Disputes between guardians who have, based on this court's precedent, have no legal obligation to support the child versus two parents in an intact family that do.
So if I'm understanding correctly, I think on the one hand, we could look at this and say it simply doesn't apply. It doesn't say anything about guardians. It says only talks about parents. And we could complete the analysis and simply say, and so there is no set off. There is no credit. You're saying that we should look at the purpose of this, determine the purpose, and fulfill the purpose under the circumstances here. And as I'm understanding it, your proposal is that the purpose is, well, why don't you tell me, what is the purpose?
Well, I think, the primary purpose of the child support guidelines, based on its own language, is to calculate support based on a parent's combined adjusted gross income estimated had been allocated to the child if the parents and the children had remained in an intact household. And so it's a complicated statute, but it's pretty simple when you break it down. We take the parents' adjusted gross income, only two parents in this case. We take their adjusted gross income, we then look to the chart and we say, here's the basic support application, and then we apply any credits to that. And back to your point of whether it was a windfall and you didn't find it persuasive, this court, Neighbors Hand versus Conley, said specifically, support is calculated to give the best, to serve the best interest of the child and not to create a windfall. And that's exactly what I think this legislature was doing when it passed 11C, is to avoid that circumstance.
So if I'm understanding correctly, so we look at the chart, we come up with a gross amount that the legislature has determined is an appropriate amount to support the child.
Correct.
And in this case, we come up with that amount based on the combined income. And then typically, we wouldn't just subtract any other, you know, trust fund or anything. We wouldn't just subtract it. We would consider it.
Correct.
And then the judge would have discretion, as I understand it. The judge would have discretion then to adjust the parents' support obligations.
I believe that's correct, except when you have a specific provision like 11C that says you have to give the credit. So I agree with you on most circumstances, but not in that one.
Okay.
And
so
what you're talking about is diminishing the basic needs of the child.
Right.
We don't talk about that in 11C. The legislature doesn't talk about that.
Okay. So then we go here and we say, but this one's different. This one says that it will be credited with regard to the parent, essentially whose income it is replacing.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. I was going to say, if the statute says that it's a credit to the disabled parent, then you're wanting us to say it has to be given, but it has to be given to both parents. And it seems like that really conflicts with the language of the statute.
Well, again, I don't think the statute was intended for this particular circumstance, but I do think that you can garner the intent in 11C. And when you look at Abrams versus Conley, is to avoid that windfall to the recipient of the child support. And so, yes, I submit it says a parent, a non-disabled parent. I can't change that fact. But I don't think that they understood this. This is tantamount to saying the state's going to get involved in how a married couple deals with their finances, because that's what it's essentially doing, is it's dealing with their finances separately when they've chosen to deal with them collectively and be a partnership in a marriage.
Well, counsel, I guess my concern is has been touched on, is kind of a separation of powers issue here. We have a situation where, as you say, the statute doesn't really talk in terms of this situation. So you're asking us to either change the language of it or make an addition to the statute. And it seems to me that there are many subjects about which the General Assembly has not spoken at all, We don't just jump in and start making laws. We say there's a gap, but that's for the legislature to fill.
And I would agree with you to a certain extent, except when you look at your all the rules of statutory construction, is that you first have to look at what the intent of the General Assembly was. And again, I go back to what 11C did and what Abrams versus Connolly did, is to avoid a windfall. Only the child support guidelines are to serve the best interest of the child. And so when you look at the rules of statutory construction, I believe this court can say, okay, it was mainly dealing with just disputes between parents. Clearly, that's the situation when it talks about a parent paying another parent, things of that nature.
Mr. West, I guess what confuses me about the situation is that you say that it impacts how a married couple can choose to distribute their finances, but there are a lot of choices about choosing to distribute your finances that have a financial implication. And so I'm not sure how that creates an unfairness when you consider the plain language of the statute.
Can you ask that question again? Not sure I follow it.
The problem is that if you credit only the disabled parent in this case because the income was lower, that they don't get the full effect of the credit, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, well, that's really a result of how they've chosen to distribute their finances. If it were different, if the mother were perhaps making more, then you wouldn't have this strange effect, right?
But no, I don't agree with the factual assumptions in that. It's because what we're dealing with in 11C is only receipt of disability income. And so there isn't a choice there because presumptively the federal government has determined that Cheryl Sidman is disabled and is unable to work. And so you're not going to have that factual situation come up where they are working and that maybe they do earn more money. So I don't think that's going to come up. To come back to and talking about statutory construction, this court said in People versus Terry, constructions that defeat the obvious legislative intent. And I've argued what I thought the legislative intent, what I believe the legislative intent was here, is to be avoided. So I'm not asking you to rework the statute. I'm asking you to look at the statute, look at what the General Assembly's intent was, and I think we can look at the General Assembly attempt, and that is to avoid this windfall. And to interpret it that way through your rules of statutory construction. I'm not asking you to rewrite the statute. I think I've addressed everything on that issue. Again, I think what's important is the 1410.115, for all its complexities, is fairly simple. You'd look at the parents' combined gross income, you determine what the presumptive amount of support is, and then you provide any credits. The interest issue on this case is that the trial court initially entered a child support order. It was 300 and some change. Guardians appealed that issue. This court reversed the trial court. And the trial court on remand entered another child support amount. Rather than say interest will run from the time after remand that I've entered my order as to support, I'm going to order retroactively from the times that it should have been owed but was improperly ordered by the trial court in the first place. First of all, I think that's incredibly unfair. Secondly, I think it violates the statute. CRS 1414.106, going back to rules of statutory construction, you give plain and ordinary meaning to the words and phrases in the statute. 1414.106 says 12% interest on child support is, quote unquote, when it's due and owing, interest accrues. It was neither due nor owing until the trial court, after remand, issued that order. So I think that was an error. Certainly the Armit case is factually distinctive from this case in that Armit dealt with a motion to modify child support. But the purpose or the reasoning of the Court of Appeals in that case is directly on point here, is we don't want to, my clients followed the court order. They always followed the court order. This court said, trial court, you were wrong. Not my client's fault, they followed the court order. And when the new order was entered, they followed that court order. So interest can only run from that date after remand that the trial court entered their order. I believe I'll try to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. West.
May it please the court, Leo Finkelstein, number 18455. For the appellees, who I refer to as the guardians. We've been before this court before on other issues. I'm going to address the issues that were raised in the opening part of this argument, and that is the legislative intent. I begin with the statute does provide to all child support obligations, period. It says any child support obligation. And so this court, in the prior two decisions relating to support, have applied 1410.115. I agree with Mr. West, it is the law of the case and it applies. In reading 1410.115, there are many provisions that talk about that each parent owes a separate support obligation based on that parent's respective share of the income. And so I'm going to refer to a few of those because the statute can't be read in isolation as just 11C. The child support guidelines are intended, and this is a quote, to allocate the amount of child support to be paid by each parent based upon physical care arrangements. That's subsection 1B3. In determining support, the court may order either or both parents owing a duty of support to pay support. That's 1410.115.2A. And then most importantly, and this one's 1410.115.7A1, in utilizing the child support obligations to determine the amount of support, the basic child support obligation shall be divided between the parents in proportion to their adjusted gross incomes. The entire statutory scheme is therefore designed to determine each parent's individual obligation for support.
But isn't the entire statutory scheme based on the premise that the parents are separate and that one has custody and one does not? How can we carry this over into your situation when the premise assumes that the child is in the custody of only one?
Well, the premise does because it comes in the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act. That's where it was created. But as noted by Judge Sells, there are many, many cases in which children are in the care of a third party, relatives, in some fashion, whether it's through an allocation of parental responsibilities case or, as in this case, a guardianship case.
Let me be clear. I'm not saying the statute should not be applied, mm-hmm. but when you make the argument that it is based on the allocation of responsibility in each parent, it is in that context. And you want us to essentially take the parents and assume that one of them has custody as to 11C, I guess we can talk about that as well. Go ahead.
I will. It's an interesting dilemma. We didn't make the argument in the trial court because if one doesn't treat them separately and looks at the custodial and looks at them as a unit, as Mr. West would argue, then there's no provision in the statute for an offset for the child support disability, not child support, for the disability payments which the guardians have sought and obtained. And so, in effect, what would happen is the actual obligation of the parents would rise by not getting that credit. We felt because the legislature did, in fact, create 11C, that it should be applied basically on its own terms, as written, and looking at the legislative intent. And there's something that really hasn't been discussed this morning that needs to be discussed. In the Supreme Court decision in DIS, they talked about the guardian's responsibilities and duties and the role, and they in effect stand in loco parentis. They take care of the child. And one of the statutory obligations, you would say, although it's not mandatory, but in CRS 1514.208.2a, it authorizes the guardians to apply for and receive money for the support of the ward, otherwise payable to the ward's parent under any statutory system of benefits or insurance. So the legislature, recognizing this, guardians may apply and get these benefits. So they do it. And under the Social Security Act, they are representative payees. From my point of view, they are standing in the shoes of the custodial parent. And in loco parentis is the words that come up in some of your cases when a third party stands in those shoes. So as the custodial parent, in effect, they are required under 1410.115.11c that the non-custodial parents, that's the disabled parent's share, shall be reduced in the amount equal to the amount of the benefit received. That statute says by the custodial parent, but in effect, the legislature has transformed the guardians into the same position.
So then in that case, do not the parents in this case both become non-custodial parents?
It's a singular statute. It says the non-custodial parent's share, meaning the disabled parent. And there's a reason that hasn't been expressed. Mr. West says, oh, that's designed to not give the custodial parent a windfall. In point of fact, there's the federal government has created a Social Security disability system which allows us to give, us as a society, to pay money from our taxes, from what we pay into the Social Security system, to a disabled parent. And that's what Cheryl Sidman receives. And at the same time, the federal government has recognized that children of disabled parents have a need as well. So they allocate money to the child. That's not child support. It's not the parent's child support. And in doing so, our legislature in Colorado has said, well, since the child is getting this money and the disabled parent is getting her disabled benefits, we're going to give a credit to the disabled parent. Otherwise, what would have happened if there were no credit is suddenly the disabled parent gets $1,500 a month, and all of a sudden they've got to pay $800 of it off in child support, and they have no money left to live. So there is an intent to the legislature, and that is not to further encumber the disabled parent, their income, when there's a dollar-for-dollar offset. Now, in saying that, I have to admit, I haven't looked at the legislative intent when they passed 11C, and I'm not sure if Mr. West has cited any actual legislative documentation as to what happened, what they were thinking of when they passed the statute. Neither of us have briefed that to the court. But there's a pretty obvious purpose there, quite aside from the windfall argument that Mr. West has made, and that is don't reduce the disabled parent's income further. Give them a credit because the child is also receiving money as a result of that system. And that makes, it just makes sense to me. So that's why you don't treat them collectively. And I'm gonna take it one step further. If you did treat it collectively, you would be in essence giving the father who makes $10,000 or more per month a dollar for dollar credit on his support obligation. And there's no legislative purpose to that. That, in a sense, gives the parents, not the child, the benefit of the federal government's largesse, if you will. I don't really think it's largesse. I think it's a very valuable program in our society. But it would be, in a sense, a windfall to the non-custodial, non-disabled parent to do that. So I'll leave that issue as it is. I'm going to move to the other issue, the Armit case, and that is the distinction that the district court drew a distinction between the decision in Armit by a panel of the Court of Appeals, the division of this court, and the basic statute is what I rely upon, in which it says interest per annum at 4% greater than the statutory rate on any arrearages and child support debt due and owing, maybe compounded monthly, and maybe collected by the judgment creditor. So the question becomes, is there an arrearage or child support debt due and owing? Mr. West argues that there isn't one until the court made its ruling on remand. And I can understand the Armit decision with respect to modifications, because when there's a modification, you have a completely new set of circumstances. And that new set of circumstances isn't going to be reduced to a child support order due and owing until the court enters an order. But on remand, it's very different. The parents made a unique argument, which the original judge hearing that issue, Judge Kennedy, agreed with, which was, we're going to include guardian's income here, parent's income here, and therefore we're going to come up with a child support number. At that point, it was $371. This court reversed that and said, no, you don't do that under the statutory scheme, and remanded. And Judge Sells went back and said, that's correct, and he came up with the new numbers. So they are retroactive. We're not arguing the retroactivity of the support, but Mr. West is arguing the retroactivity of the interest that goes with it. The parents in this case invited the error. They're the ones that made the argument to Judge Kennedy in the first place. They knew there was a duty of support, and the question is only the amount. So they invite the error. The error occurs for this court. It's corrected. In the interim years, from when the first of those payments would have been due, which is December 1, 2007, until the ruling in 2011 on remand, the guardians have not had the support that was due and owed. In effect, they are either reducing the amount that they have available to use for the child, or using their own money, and therefore not able to invest that and do other things with that towards their retirement or whatever purposes they might otherwise have. They've lost the benefit and value of that money. And so it makes sense to me on remand in this kind of a situation that interest should accrue per the statute on any arrearage in child support debt due and owing. And the fact that it may take, because of the appellate process, some length of time to get an appellate decision, then you have a motion for remand, and then a trial and a ruling, it takes a while. The fact that it takes that time should not work to the disadvantage of the child for whom the money and interest ultimately is due. It's the child's entitlement.
Yeah, how is that different, though, if there's a modification that's retroactive? In that instance, the guardian or parent who was due the money under the modified order would still not have had the money to invest or to do whatever.
Well, in Armand, the court said because there's not been an order changing it, they're relying on the order. I think, first of all, with due respect, it wasn't this panel, but I don't actually agree with the reasoning in Armand. I think that when the retroactivity goes back to the payment date, the interest should accompany it. But aside from that, the distinction is there is no order until the modification. There's no way to know it. But in this case, there was. It was argued at the trial court in 2008 when the case went to trial. Judge Kennedy ruled one way. This court reversed. Judge Sells simply said, okay, we're not going to take the guardian's income into account. Therefore, here's the numbers. The income for the parents didn't change. The number didn't change under the child support guideline. All that changed is we took the guardian's number out of the worksheet. And so I think there is a distinction that way, but I do recognize it's difficult to reconcile that, and that's why I also posit that I'm not sure that Armand was in fact properly decided. I think the interest should go with the due date of the payments.
Mr. Finkelstein, the usual rule with regard to prejudgment interest is that there was an obligation in existence and it was withheld. And so in this case, how would you apply that? I'm not persuaded by the concerns about the guardian's wherewithal. Right. But I am more concerned about, was there any withholding by, in effect, withholding by the parents of amounts that it was being required to pay during the prejudgment term?
If the prejudgment term is considered when the judge did his order on remand, then no, they paid the $371 per month. They did not withhold it. And so in that sense, your answer is correct, no. But if there was in fact an order in December, starting December 2007, and the order was simply wrong as to amount, and amount only, and I believe the interest should attach itself, if you will, to the increased amount when you're dealing with a remand situation. I do recognize the court's concern there. I just think that the interest should attach to the amount that was due and owing. And I would posit that's the legislative intent, that when you read 1414.106. One other quick matter, just so you should understand it was in the briefs, it wasn't addressed by Mr. West, but I do want to point out the exhibits D, E, and F, which I attached to my brief, which were from the record, are the actual child support calculations that the court utilized. They are attached to the answer brief. What's important is that Mr. West, in his brief, made the argument that the father didn't actually get credit for the transportation expenses and health insurance, when in fact he did. And in the record, it was Exhibit Q, but in the record in Exhibit Q, there's an identical worksheet without those factors in there, and if they were removed, his support would be even higher. Okay, so the argument that there was no credit really has no merit whatsoever.
And
I
don't
think you're focusing on that, but I want to make sure you understand it.
And in D, E, and F, where is that credit reflected?
In D, E, and F, it's reflected under lines 6C and 6E. And if you were to remove those, I didn't reproduce for the court Exhibit Q, but if you were to remove those, his bottom line number would increase.
And so that's on Exhibit D, that's $591?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. West, you have just about a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly on the interest, since that was one of the last things that was talked about, counsel's statement was, when dealing with the modification of child support, that there is no way to know it until it's actually modified. That's no different than when this court overturns a trial court and sends it back. There was no way for my parents, for my clients, to know that their child support obligation would be modified. Also, the purpose of this high interest rate on child support is to provide for speedy payment, and I cited case law in support of that. That serves no purpose. There is no way to get speedy payment when they didn't know how much they were going to pay. Briefly, counsel brought up that there's numerous cases and situations that we deal with where people have, non-parents have a child in their care. That's true, but we've dealt with that in other contexts, and they've dealt with it very differently. In Roderick, in Ray of the Marriage of Roderick, this court said that somebody who seeks allocation of parental responsibilities for a child has a legal obligation to support a child. That's not the case here. These guardians have argued successfully, we're not parents, we have no legal obligation to support this child. So those are very different circumstances. Thank you, Your Honor, I really appreciate it.
Counsel, again, thank you for your arguments. They are helpful, and given that the statute is the way it is in this case, they were necessary. This case now stands submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.